I've been shooting since I was young. It's something I enjoy, and it's something my father and I used to do. There was a time I was going through some things. I wasn't feeling like myself, and my friend noticed and asked me if he could hold on to my guns temporarily. At first, I was a little shocked, but I agreed. I think he saved my life that day.
If a loved one is depressed, ask to temporarily store guns away from home. Need help? Text MT to 741-741 or call 800-273-TALK. Sponsored by DPHHS and aired by the NBA.
Welcome to A New Day with Susan, your host, transformation and mindset coach Susan Yockey, bringing you the inspiration, strategies, and tools to empower you to take action in achieving your goals.
Hello, and welcome to A New Day with Susan. I'm your host, Susan Yockey, and I have a very powerful and courageous and bold story interview for you today. It's just going to blow your mind. This man is absolutely amazing, and I'm super excited about having him on our show today because this topic definitely does not get talked about enough. So I'll start off with sharing more about Brian and his story, and then we'll just kind of let you take over, Brian. First off, He quotes, "We become a superhero," writes adult Brian Cardoza in a letter to his six-year-old self. "We are mighty little ones, and we are brave." Brian suffered repeated sexual assault and physical abuse as a child. He left home at the age of 15, nearly freezing to death the first night on his own. Brian knows the trauma and despair victims must overcome to survive. He not only chose to survive, he chose to give voice to an unspeakable topic and to challenge the stigma and shame often associated with male survivors of abuse. Now, an inspirational speaker, author, and artist, Brian's message is one of responsibility and hope. Brian's work is he diligently raises awareness and money to fight against childhood sexual assault and physical abuse. A believer in the potential to change, Brian's motto, "Don't let this moment dictate the next moment," is familiar to many that he inspires. And Brian, his story has been featured in a number of national and international projects, including a documentary for the EU, Forced, Promise, Places documentary, Ripple Effects, the Bristlecone Project, and Huffington Post, HuffPost, live segment for Child Abuse Awareness Month. He has been a contributing poet for Purple Sparks and a keynote speaker for a multitude of events highlighting abuse. And he's a certified OVCTTAC consultant, which I'll let Brian share a little bit about the abbreviation of that, and RAIN speaker. Brian's love for art began with drawing as a child. He experimented with different mediums from charcoal to stone sculpting. Stopping for a number of years to focus on culinary endeavors, Brian picked art back up at a time when he felt most alone. Today, Brian's art takes various forms, including magnificently colored, refurbished bicycles that he donates to children. He's passionate about learning new techniques and styles, and the creative process continues to heal the child within. Brian founded the Broken Knee Club, a nonprofit organization created to provide a safe haven for all sexes to comfortably speak out about their experience of childhood and adult sexual assault. In collaboration with others, Brian is building Survivor Nights, a community healing through creative expression. Survivor Nights exhibits highlight the enormity of the journey from trauma to healing through dark and bright works of art. Brian's words of encouragement to survivors: your darkest moments may be the light for another. Welcome to A New Day with Susan, Brian.
Thank you. I didn't realize my bio, that was the short bio too.
I know, you know, and I usually just kind of pick pieces out of bios, but I actually, that was so inspiring that I just wanted to make sure that I shared every bit of that. And I just want to acknowledge you right off the bat. You're being bold and courageous and so generous in sharing your story so that others can find a way to heal as well. So I want to thank you for that.
Well, thank you for affirming what I've been trying to do. It's a strange world. I've recently come into conclusion that my life probably was worse than I thought it was because I tell people parts of it and they're just like, really? And I'm just like, what, that didn't happen to everybody, you know? And so it's a bit bewildering. I've never considered myself brave. I've never considered myself bold. I've never considered myself any of those things. I've just considered myself as a human being with a responsibility to help other people. When I did the Bristol Cone Project with 1in6.org and David Lezak, he wrote my short bio there, and he starts it out with one of my quotes is, you know, I'm just trying to become the man that I needed as a child. And that's what I needed as a kid. I needed a man that would come to me and say, I believe you. I know that this is happening and we're going to do something about it. If I can't do something about it, we're going to try to make at least some parts of your life bearable to where you have some hope. And so that's what I've been trying to do. I'm so surprised when people are like, you're so brave. I'm like, I'm not really brave, because all I'm really saying is that we shouldn't rape each other. You know what I mean? Like that's, yeah. It's not really a statement to say. It's kind of a sad one to have to make. So thank you for that wonderful intro. The OVC is the Office for Victims of Crime, and I am their consultant for anytime they need a speaker for child, like especially male sex abuse. People can go through the OVC and book me and ask me to come out to their events and stuff like that. It's been a pretty fun life, I guess. It's always amazing to me. So yeah. I don't know, where would you like me to go from here?
Well, I was just in what you were sharing. You're right. There's not a voice out there to speak up about childhood sexual abuse, especially with men. And I started hearing men coming forth in the work that I do on a stage in front of anywhere from 50 to 500 people, where they're getting coached through their process, and a lot of it's usually blocked off and they don't know nothing about what happened. They just know that they're walking around pissed off and angry at the world, and anything could set them off, or they don't trust anybody, or, you know, their communication skills, you know, because they have that fear of someone probably finding out. I don't know, but what I've seen, and the most beautiful thing is the man just letting go of that stuff and really getting to the root cause of those things from their childhood. And when they share those experiences and they're so vulnerable, it really gave me another view of a man. It really is true what they say. You look tough on the outside, but on the inside, you're a big teddy bear. And, we just have different language, and, you know, as a male and a female. So I think it's absolutely beautiful. And that's why I feel you're so courageous and brave, is because it takes a certain amount, you know, just that kind of courage to be that vulnerable and sharing yourself with the world. because I feel like if men were healing that stuff, like, oh my gosh, like they really make an impact in not only their life, but in the lives of others and their loved ones.
Well, I feel that part of the reason why I feel like I should speak out more.
All right, everybody. I know this is rough. We don't want to take off to a break, but we need to. Why does Brian feel like he should speak out more?
This is Sergeant Jones. Please respond. I was separated from my squad, requesting backup. Anyone, please respond. I'm all alone here.
You're not alone. If you're hurting or considering suicide, call for backup. 800-273-TALK or text MT to 741-741. We need you. Your family needs you. Suicide is not the answer. Get help. Sponsored by DPHHS and aired by the Montana Broadcasters Association.
Welcome back to A New Day with Susan. I'm your host, Susan Yockey, and today I'm interviewing Brian Cardoza, international speaker, author, and artist. You can find out more about Brian or connect with him at www.briancardoza.com.
Is because I kind of experience both sides of a spectrum. Mm-hmm. So my molestation, when I was being raped, I was 6 years old till I was nine. So that's 80 to 83. And growing up in that time era, men weren't raped. You know what I mean? Like it didn't happen. Men were rapists. They weren't rapers. They weren't victims. So growing up in a world where women started, because like, remember, you know, in the 70s, women really started to come forward and actually confront rape culture.
Yeah.
And so in the early 80s, it was just, you only heard about women.
Right.
It was only women that got raped. And growing up in an era where you're 6 years old, being told that this only happens to women, you start to realize and start to, in a false sense, you start to realize that you suffered something that only women went through. And yeah. So that must mean that you weren't man enough, that you weren't strong enough or brave enough, or, you know what I mean? Like, you still hear it today when people be like, I'd kill a guy if I did that. Like, well, no, you wouldn't. Because if you were six, you wouldn't know. You would be in the exact same position I would.
Right.
I grew up with this spectrum of knowing I had suffered a thing that only women suffered, and I was obviously the only male that ever had it happen to him. We already knew that. And then growing up in a household where I was the servant of the household, I was even further isolated, even to believing that I was literally the only one. So I grew up, you know, doing the same thing that guys and girls at my age did now. You know, grew up on Conan movies and Conan books, and found out that masculinity is a non-emotional and take what you want, kill them, and, you know, savage the women, and, you know what I mean, all this kind of toxic masculinity attitude. And so I grew up knowing that in my head, I was weaker than a woman, but because I was growing so much and so strong naturally, I was stronger than a man. So I was like caught in both worlds. And it played out when I got older, to where at 15, when my mom threw me out, you know, I tell people all the time, I had a choice that night, and that choice was I could either die and just go to sleep, because it was, you know, I grew up in Anchorage, Alaska, and it was December 14th, 1989, and really cold. I'll never forget how cold it was. And I'm trying to sleep in that car, and the idea of dying was actually rather attractive, you know. It was
right.
And so And then the idea of going back home and begging to get let back in was even more boresome. I mean, like, there was just no way I was going to do that to give my mom and my brother another opportunity to tell me how much of a failure I was. So the only choice I had was to fight. The only choice I had was to keep going. You know what I mean? Like, that was literally the only choice I had. So, yeah, I took it. And because of that toxic masculinity that I thought that I needed to prove myself as a man, you know, I lived on the streets for 2 years. And when my friends would get high, I got higher. When I got drunk, when they got drunk, I got more drunk. When they had a one night stand, I had 12. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I did this entire overcompensation that you look back on life and you're just like, how did I live with myself? You know?
Yeah.
And when you come to that realization, when you become to the point where you're more introspective than extrospective, you realize that the things that you made mistakes on, you have to acknowledge, accept, and hold on dear, because you learned an incredible lesson during those mistake making years. But at the same time, that, you know, you didn't have a choice in what happened to you, but you do have a choice on how you react from it. And yeah. So at 30, I was in a relationship with a lady. It was like one of those perfect relationships. She was an airline attendant. So it was like, you know, she'd come into town for 3 or 4 days. We'd have a lot of fun. She'd leave and I'd be like, I'm free again. You know? And so,
yeah, that would be perfect, right?
Yeah, it was. And so one day she tells me, she was one of those relationship partners where they try to pick a fight. You know, they literally will throw stuff at you to try to get you to argue or something.
Yeah.
I had numbed myself to the point to where I just didn't feel anything. And Susan, it was hilarious. Like, when I think back on it, it's hilarious. She looked at me one night and she just yelled. She was just like, you have no passion. And I just looked at her. And Susan, I kid you not, my reaction was, yep. Like, yeah. So like she's trying to get a rise out of me. And she's trying to get pissed off. And I'm just like, you're right. And so
what'd she do?
She got more mad because yeah. I was like, and so we broke up and I went home and I pulled myself into a bottle for about 2 days and got sober enough to look up the Boston Area Rape Crisis Center and went and sought therapy. And I'll tell you know, there's a reason why a lot of guys don't come forward nowadays. And it's something that we as men need to overcome and women need to work on a little bit, because this was probably the second most traumatic thing that happened to me for recovery wise.
Mm-hmm.
I went into the rape crisis center. And there were like these four ladies off into an office. And I walk up the stairs to the crisis center and I sit in these, remember the 1970s really ugly fake green kitchen chairs? So they had a couple of those chairs in the waiting room. So I sat in one of them and one of the ladies comes out of the office and sees me and she walks up to me and she's like, can I help you? And I'm like, well, I'm waiting for my appointment. Oh, and then just walked off. And then unilaterally, every single lady from that office came out and accosted me verbally in the exact same way until I had had enough. And I was just like, I'm here to meet David Shannon, my therapist, for our first interview, for my first session. Does he even know I'm here? You know what I mean? And you could tell that they were just like, oh, so you're a client, not a perpetrator. And so,
oh, wow.
And well, and I'll be honest with you, Susan, you know, telling my story, I've heard stories from people where they called the crisis center to report their own rape as a male. And they were told straight up right when they said, I need help. And the person on the phone said, we don't help predators.
Wow.
You know, And so it's, you know, it's one of those things that women do need to work on a little bit. We're not, you know, and by no sense of the word are men oppressed. You know, that's just such the wrong word for it. We are underserved, but we are nowhere near oppressed in the industry. But the one thing that we have to, as men, understand also is that, you know, for 40 years, women have been fighting this fight, and they have been on the front lines. They have taken every bloody lip, every black eye, every, you know, knock to the back of the head that they possibly could, and are still fighting. And for 40 years, they've heard nothing but horrendous stories about what men do to women.
Yeah.
So, of course, there's going to be pushback. Like on the Me Too movement, mm-hmm. a bunch of my friends got just hammered for being Me Too. So, I mean, of course that's going to happen.
Yeah.
And we have to make room for it, and we have to accept it. But in ordinary for us to get through that, women also have to accept and push through their bias also.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe we can get on to a communal group therapy session where we realize that men and women go through the exact same thing. We go through the same traumas. We go through the same questions. Mm-hmm. We go through the same, you know, everything right down the line is the exact same. And there's only been one difference that I've ever found, Susan. And that difference is, I have never met a woman who has said this question.
Oh, just when this is really getting good, you guys. I can't wait to find out why Brian has never met a woman who has asked the question. We will find out what that question is when we come back.
So I'm a cat, and I just moved in with this new human, and she's got this little toy she's always playing with all day long. Tap, 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 bloop, bloop. She can't put it down. There it is. Oh, and get this. She even talks to it. Last week, she asked it for Chinese, and guess what? Egg rolls showed up, like magic. Humans have cool toys.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org.
Welcome back to A New Day with Susan. I'm your host, Susan Yockey, and today I'm interviewing Brian Cardoza, international speaker, author, and artist. You can find out more about Brian or connect with him at www.briancardoza.com.
But every man has asked it, and this question was, does this make me gay? I've never heard a woman say that. Every male survivor I've ever heard say that.
Which makes sense. It's, that's an interesting question.
Well, and I think the reason why men ask that is because your body reacts and does things naturally. And the stimulation is still stimulation. Your body does not just be like differentiate between this and that. Like when a man is being raped and the prostate is being massaged, there are things that naturally happen that you can't fight. And so every guy I've met that has been gone through this, they ask that question. And there's something about asking a fundamental question about your entire being that shakes men. And it shakes us to the point of where we fall into that toxic crap. I was far too lazy of a human being to hate an entire group of people because of what happened to me. Mm-hmm. Like I never had any, I was like, that weight takes way too much energy to hate an entire group of people. You know what I mean? Like, I just don't have that. So like, I don't like the guy who raped me. I don't care if you're gay. That person I want to find in the dark alley. All the rest of you have that. You know? So I never had that kind of energy, and I always just blame it because I was lazy. But it's just the way it is. It's a beautiful thing because until David Channon, my therapist, sat me down and asked me the pointed question, what did he do to you? I was still actively drinking every day or getting high on some substance every single day, or trying to find another conquest. So I was, you know, I was all over the place. And the minute he started asking me about, and had the courage to ask me, because David wasn't a very large man, and I'm 6'2". And at that time, I was roughly about 280 pounds and 11% body fat.
Yeah.
I would, you know, I mean, I'm just a very large human being in general. And even then I was in good shape, and I was just, and he still had that courage to look me dead in the face and be like, what did he do?
Yeah.
And that was the moment the healing started. And that's the moment a lot of men need to get to. Yeah. You know, the saddest part about this entire thing is men could have more support and more help from men if we could literally just get out of our own ways.
Yeah.
And report. And just actually report. Realize it has nothing to do with our masculinity. It has nothing to do with what our sex is. It's literally a traumatic event that you need to report and come forward and start receiving help for it. And
yeah.
You can't mask it with booze and drugs and sex and boorish behavior. You have to come forward. And most importantly, I find, at least for my scenario, you have to help other people, because I was okay when I was doing my work just on myself.
Mm-hmm.
I really was okay. I could have gone another 40 or 50 years just that way. But the minute I started putting myself out there to help other survivors, I found a new level of healing that I didn't think ever existed. You know, I think it speaks to the masculinity in me. And I think if more men did it, it would speak to the real true masculinity in men. Because I did a video recently where I think that people need to admit that a masculinity failed, because like it was supposed to bring equality. It was supposed to bring justice. It was supposed to be, we're going to do this for now, and then we're going to stand together. And it failed. It literally failed that. We have minorities that don't have equal standing, women that do not have equal standing, but typically white men, we're gold. You know what I mean? Like, so in a lot of ways, masculinity failed. And yeah. We need to let go of it and realize that real masculinity is a group of people that are willing to bring peace and help and prosperity to everyone, mm-hmm. not just a gender because you look like me or love like me. And so when I found a true definition of masculinity, as in I will give away my privacy so that some child or some kid, I don't care what gender, reads my story and goes, I can do this. He did this. I can do this.
Yeah.
And that to me is masculinity. That to me means I am still helping take care of my tribe of people, which on a global planet is just the human race.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's what masculinity needs to turn into, the realization that we need to take care of our species. And so when I started doing work with people and helping them come forward and helping them with art and speak and write their speeches. And even if they never spoke on an audience before, I still have helped people write their speeches, you know, so that they can get it out and feel like they can speak it. I hit a new level of recovery that, you know, my joke is that for years, I'll be full blown in recovery, Susan, 20 minutes into my funeral. Okay. Now, because of this stuff, I feel like I'll be in recovery like 12 minutes into my funeral.
I love it. And you still have this whole life ahead of you. It's beautiful.
One can hope. Yeah, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, I learned at a very young age, never count on the sunrise. So, So, you know, as long as it's still coming up, as long as I'm still seeing it, I'm going to still keep fighting.
Yeah. And you went through a lot more than just the sexual abuse. There were a lot of other traumas that happened throughout your childhood. Did you want to share about any of that?
Yeah. I mean, there was, so my brother is the one that sold me into sex trafficking, my older brother.
Wow.
And he sold me because I made his father go away. And the reason why he thought that was because my mother had convinced him that the reason why our father didn't stay within the family, and this is a direct quote, Susan, he left this family because you couldn't make him love it. So I was put on this planet in my mother's last ditch effort to keep this man that wanted nothing to do with her. And so my father blames me for keeping him there for another 6 years. My mother blamed me for not keeping him there for longer. And she convinced my brother that I was the reason he left. So because I was a failure at home, I got the failure's duties. So every morning it was chores and get everybody up, make sure. Now, bear in mind, I'm like 6 and 7 years old. So my duties every single day were to get everybody up, make breakfast, make sure everybody had clean clothes, make sure everybody was ready to go to work or school. And then if I had time, I could take a shower and get something to eat and go to school myself. So, you know, needless to say, I just wrote it the other day. It's hilarious. I didn't really have great time management skills at 7. So there were quite a few days where preschool and kindergarten, I was kind of ripe. I didn't learn time management until about 9 years old. My mom would beat me if I didn't get the living room done. It was nothing to have wire coat hanger welts across my back or broomsticks or whatever. They would itch a little bit in the 1980s sweaters that you would wear. Yeah. Those horrendous things. And then every day it was.
Okay, you guys know what time it is. We're going to head out onto a brief break, but we're going to come back and find out what was life like as a child for Brian every day.
My best friend could tell something was wrong. I tried to hide it, but she knew I was lying. I wasn't okay. Far from it. I felt isolated, lonely, depressed. She kept telling me I wasn't alone and urged me to get help. I think she saved my life. When it comes to suicide, the only wrong thing to say is to say nothing at all.
If you or a loved one needs help, text MT to 741-741 or call 800-273-TALK. Brought to you by DPHHS and aired by the NBA.
Welcome back to A New Day with Susan. I'm your host, Susan Yockey, and today I'm interviewing Brian Cardoza, international speaker, author, and artist. You can find out more about Brian or connect with him at www.briancardoza.com.
Every day it was, I was a failure, I was worthless, I was useless. Because you're recording, I'm not going to say some of the other choice words.
Yeah, we can imagine.
Yeah, I was told on a regular basis how lucky I was that I wasn't aborted. You know what I mean? Like, just some pretty heinous stuff from somebody that was really supposed to love you. But, you know, there's something to be said about mental illness. And mental illness doesn't go away the minute a woman has a child. You know what I mean? Like, if that happened, there'd be a whole lot happier people in this world too, you know? So the reality is that I was born into a situation that I had no control over. And for a lot of years, I didn't have control over it either because I just was rebelling. And now as I've gotten older, I've realized I had a choice and I continue to choose how I handle it now. And one of the things that helped me with that, Susan, I want to let the world know, whoever hears this, that maybe this will help them, is that I'm a very linear thinker. I spent 23 years as a chef because it was very comfortable for me to follow recipes and, you know, like this order in, that order out, this and then, you know what I mean? Like, so when I started to think about what happened to me as a kid, I developed a timeline. So, and that timeline is that from the minute I started being raped to the minute he was done, okay? So not the grooming, not that, just the actual deed itself, was probably about 45 minutes of time in my life. The amount of time that my mom would physically beat me was probably about 3 weeks of time. The mental and severe abuse was about 3 months of just, you know, the constant berating, belittling, all that stuff. So one day I'm looking at it, Susan, and I realize, like, I could possibly live to maybe my mid 70s. I'm a big guy. I might go earlier, but, you know, the life expectancy is what, 76 right now.
Mm-hmm.
So how can I let 45 minutes, 3 days, and 3 months be greater than 70 years of life?
Like, wow.
That's just, it's terrible math. You know, like, there's nobody in the world that would be like, oh yeah, no, that's more. Like, no, this is more. You have more chances to make people smile and you smile than the time you didn't feel like it.
Yeah.
So linearly, I was able to look at this and be like, that just doesn't make sense. So when I started to think like that, I was able to then really get the most out of my trauma-informed therapy. I was able to get more out of my introspection. I was able to be more honest with myself because I was able to look at things in a linear way and just be like, no, 76 years is far more than 45 minutes, 3 days, and 3 months.
Right.
So I have more opportunity here.
Yeah. No, that's really powerful, because what I hear in that is, this is what happened to me. And you can choose to continue to allow that to happen, even though it's not happening now, for the rest of the 70 years you have on this planet, or you can choose to recover, leave that in the past and be free from it, so that you can live a life that you dream of living or desire to live.
You know, I don't think that at any point in time you'll be free of it, because those 3 days and 45 minutes and 3 months still happened, and they're still part of the
76
year.
Yeah, it's in memory. And where does our memory come from?
Yeah. And so what I try to explain to people is that, you know, it's an important to acknowledge that, and it's an important to acknowledge it's always going to be a part of your life.
Yeah.
And you may never, ever fully recover from that. But what it does boil down to is, do you have more good days than bad days? And how much time, when you do think about it, are you dwelling within that? You still have to face it. You still have to every day.
Feel it. Susan, yeah.
You know, you read my bio, and that's the short one. Every single day, I still think about my mom telling me I'm a worthless failure. You know what I mean? Like, I still think about that every single day. She still has her marathon shoes on in my head and still keeps running laps. You know, quick story. And on the October 15th here in this town, New Bern, I was at the university. I was going to sign up for classes to start becoming a full-fledged therapist. And there was a gunman on campus. And so there's this guy running around with a gun on campus. They put the school in lockdown.
Mm.
And so I went straight into survivor mode. There was 14 people in the room with me. So I got everybody into a room. We turned off the lights. We closed the window. It was their lunchroom in their office. And I took the door position because in my head, I knew that if the guy came in to this building, that he was going to have to face me to kill anybody in this room. And if he killed me, he would have to then remove me from the area, because what I did was I sat down in front of the door, the single access door, so that if he shot me, I would become a door wedge versus fall. And so I take this position because in my head, Susan, I'm like, there's no way I'm letting these people die. There's just, I would go first. And then in my head, I'm thinking to myself, see, Mom, I have worth. See, Mom, I am not a failure. Yeah. And in my head, I'm thinking these things. And this is now, 43 years later, and I'm still, actually it's 44, I'm still fighting these entire concept of my mother's words in my head. And I've accomplished a lot. I've done a lot. So yeah, I still have these issues, but tomorrow I can get up and go find another survivor and be like, talk to me, what's going on? Mm-hmm. That's what matters. You know what I mean? Like, so I don't want anybody to think that if you think linear, like it goes away.
Well, it doesn't go away. What happened happened when it happened. And what I'm pointing to is from a science perspective and point of view, there is no such thing as a past and there is no such thing as a future, because all we have is right now. And you're choosing to live in the now, even though you have past thoughts that tend to run our show. That's the old programming, the old pattern mindset from, growing up. And trauma is a lot more challenging, I believe, to, deal with, especially on a day-to-day basis. And that's what I love about the power of choice, is we can choose to allow those thoughts to keep us there, or because our mind doesn't know if we're living in the moment. It doesn't know that the past is in the past, or if the future's in the future. It doesn't care. It doesn't know yes or no. It just knows this is what happened and I've got to survive. And things will trigger those things. And I really love you, because your message is that, from what I'm hearing, is like, there is hope. There is a possibility of healing the past, of those things that have happened, one, by making a difference in other people's lives and not keeping it held in and freeing yourself from that. And I just really acknowledge you again for being so courageous and vulnerable and sharing and being a stand for, because I really got that you're committed to men, especially healing that kind of trauma. And stop walking around and holding it in.
I don't think I typecast as a guy survivor. I really want to just, I don't care if you're a kumquat and you felt like this has happened to you. I want to help you. So it's a challenge. And here's the beauty of it, is that every time I meet a survivor like yourself, or anybody that has been through the things that I've been through or what you've been through, we all seem to be highly intelligent. And I think it's because we were forced to adapt to adult situations at very early ages. And it gives you a breadth of knowledge and understanding and an awareness that the normal folk don't have. like you said about forgiveness, I'm not big on forgiveness. I am big on understanding. I put it in my book. If you don't mind, I'll just the book.
No, yeah, definitely share about that. Definitely.
My mom, I don't believe in this planet that there was ever a parent that gave birth to a child that said, I'm going to treat my kid worse than what I was treated. I believe every single one of them has felt that they tried to do better than what they received as themselves. Mm-hmm. So if I look at it from that perspective, and I look at how poorly my mom treated me, then I kind of develop a sense of pity for what my mom went through. because she must have gone through some stuff. You know, her mom died at 38. Yeah, you know, her mom died at 38 from alcohol, from liver failure. So she must have went through some stuff herself. And so I don't forgive my mom for what she said and did. I don't, because the stuff that she did was a literal and figurative unforgivable acts. But I can understand where she came from, and I can understand her motives and why she thought that what she was doing wasn't as bad as it was, because she had gone through worse. I'll never forgive my brother because he didn't go through what I went through, but he was taught. You know, so he was instructed. And at no point in time did he question the instruction. So that's why I don't forgive him. I can understand that he was taught that, but I don't understand why he questioned it.
Yeah.
I questioned the stuff every day. Now, until I was 12, I'll be honest with you, Susan, I didn't know I was being beaten and molested. I didn't know that these things didn't happen to Brandon, who lived next door. I didn't, you know, I hadn't, this was just
Tuesday. But it seemed like her life.
Yeah, so when I turned 12, and I literally grew 1 foot over the summer. So like I was this big, and then all of a sudden, boom, and like, and I noticed that the beating stopped, you know, because it was just like they would hit me, and I'd just be like, "What?" Yeah, you know. So, And I started to take advantage of the fact that I wasn't going to get beat anymore. So I started to make friends. I started to talk to people, and I started to see that in other people's families, that there wasn't a beating because the vacuuming didn't get done correctly, or there wasn't a belittling because there was a spot on a glass. And that's when I started to really be like, so what's going on? You know? And so that's part of the reason why I don't forgive my brother, because he was older than me. He was allowed to have friends. He was allowed to have interactions and social interactions with people. And he still refused to question his treatment of me. So I can understand. I refuse to forgive because what happened was unforgivable. My rapist, he killed himself when he was 18 in Seattle. So I never really got a chance to even confront him. So I don't know if I will ever understand or forgive him. But I also realize that in the way I think and the way I live my life, it's not necessarily important for me to forgive him. It is important for me to forgive myself for the thoughts that I had somehow asked for this. That's the more important part. And that's, you know, understanding where I'm coming from in regards to, I didn't ask for this. And as much crap as I went through because of it, I made some choices that put me in jail for a little bit, that actually got me into positions where I was in them because of my choices. Yeah. And so if I can choose to get put in jail because of my choices, then my choices can lead me away from it also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And those are the things that I've tried to learn.
Yeah. Yeah, I got that. I got that. And you're right. The first and foremost important thing is to find forgiveness for yourself. And that is a huge part of the healing process.
And it's the hardest out of all the craziest things
in the world. It is the hardest. It really is. Isn't that crazy? Like what would make me do something so bad that's happened to me that I can't forgive myself?
And it's the hardest. Yeah. You're like, okay.
We're the hardest on ourselves. That's for sure. Is there a way that our listeners can connect with you? I'm sure a lot of people are wanting to connect with you or are currently connecting with you. So what way can they do that?
Well, they can reach me through my website, briancardoza.com. That's B-R-I, which is the only cool way to spell it, A-N, cardoza.com, or you can reach me at Survivor Knights, but that's like Knights
of that.
Yeah, K-N-I-G-H-T, on Facebook, where you can find me on Facebook or Twitter and Instagram, you know, social media, Darlene I am. And you can also buy my book at Barnes & Noble's and Amazon.com, The Unexpected Victim. You know, trying to get the message out that men survive this, and we're not just perpetrators. A lot of us are victims.
That's right. Yeah, never judge a book by its cover, right?
Nope.
Yep. All right. Well, I just want to thank you for being on my show, and just keep doing the amazing things that you're doing out there to bring awareness to our children. And that's really what it's about. We've got to educate our children. Was there anything else you'd like to add before we finish up the interview?
No. Well, yeah, publicly, I'd like to say thank you again for giving men a voice. One man a voice. It's very often not found. So thank you for the opportunity. And if any of your male survivors and female survivors want, please know full well you can reach me any way you can.
Awesome. Contact A New Day with Susan. Email Susan at coachsusanyaki@gmail.com. Keep your excellent feedback and comments coming. Your host, Susan Yaki, is an expert in transformation and mindset. Susan is a motivational speaker, leads coaching programs and online and offline workshops in how to rewrite your history and creating achievable goals so you can live a life created by you.
I've been shooting since I was young. It's something I enjoy, and it's something my father and I used to do. There was a time I was going through some things. I wasn't feeling like myself, and my friend noticed and asked me if he could hold on to my guns temporarily. At first, I was a little shocked, but I agreed. I think he saved my life that day.
If a loved one is depressed, ask to temporarily store guns away from home. Need help? Text MT to 741-741 or call 800-273-TALK. Sponsored by DPHHS and aired by the NBA.